A body on the train tracks in mysterious circumstances.
Mark's been found on railway tracks.
An award-winning ABC podcast and a fresh inquest underway.
Every time we walk out of that inquest, just being like, oh my God.
You weren't out there on the train tracks that night?
Absolutely not.
As the answers get closer, the podcast is back.
He said he's guilty. He's guilty as sin.
Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Kate Reid is the founder and director of Lune Croissanterie, whose croissants are so good and so famous that people line up before dawn to get their hands on one. Even the French are impressed by Kate's creations. She was recently awarded France's Order of Agricultural Merit for redefining the croissant. But becoming a world-famous pastry chef was not Kate's dream growing up. Instead, her focus was on something much louder and faster than croissants, Formula One race cars. Kate and her dad, Bob, shared an obsessive love of Formula One, and Kate worked very hard to become one of the very few women working in race car design in the UK. When that dream didn't work out, she found herself in a dark place, until puff pastry eventually helped her to find a way out. Kate's memoir is Destination Moon. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks so much for having me.
Did your family eat croissants when you were a kid?
For me, a croissant was a croissant from Baker's Delight. We would typically order them on like a birthday or Christmas to have on breakfast on special occasions.
So. And now my experience as a kid with croissants in Australia was they might come frozen from the supermarket. Is there anything you can do to rescue a frozen croissant?
I don't think so.
Just an abomination?
It's an abomination.
You had bad asthma as a little kid. How vividly do you remember that sensation of struggling to breathe?
It's funny, from time to time, I still am affected by asthma in a small way. If I get a really bad cold, it will affect my breathing. But I don't have much memory of the idea of really not being able to breathe. For me, it's more the sensation of being highly medicated to treat it. I think Mum and Dad would jump on it as quickly as, like, as soon as they knew that I was starting to go down the path of potentially having an attack. They became knowledgeable enough in the treatment. They'd get me onto prednisolone or cortisone or the nebulizer. And oh, this is so weird. I've never actually said this out loud to anyone, but as a little kid, I remember having this feeling of like floating on my fingertips just above my bed. And I don't, like, while I was lying down, that. And I don't know if that was an effect or the sensation of the medication and a half sleep dream state, but that feeling and memory is far more visceral to me than the actual not being able to breathe.
Did it mean that you were wrapped in cotton wool a little bit as a kid? Were your parents worried about you overextending yourself physically or anything like that?
I think it's safe to say I was absolutely wrapped in cotton wool. Affected my social ability a little bit later on in life, like early primary school years. But when I was very young, because an asthma attack could occur at any time and, you know, little things would trigger it, like too much laughter or having something with preservatives in it that reacted badly with me. I think Mum and Dad were probably concerned about sending me to other people's houses for play dates if they weren't around. So I think I became very dependent on Mum and Dad and very close to them as a result. But yeah, also things like very early school days, not really being able to participate in more high energy sports like running and tiggy at playtime and things like that. So the feeling of being wrapped in cotton wool is probably an accurate one.
Did the world feel a little like a dangerous place, do you think, to you as a kid?
I think the idea of being wrapped in cotton wool by my parents inadvertently made me feel a bit like the world was potentially a bit scary. Once I was sort of old enough to develop independent friendships, I didn't like going to friends' houses for playdates. I prefer if they came to my house. I was nervous about competing in things like, you know, the inter-school cross-country yearly events because I was concerned about what might happen rather than throwing myself in and thinking I might be completely fine. Let's see if asthma comes from this.
How competitive were you with schoolwork? So you weren't doing TIGGY, you weren't enjoying the cross country. What about, you know, maths tests?
When you think about primary school, one of the main ways that you make friends in primary school or form a level of popularity is through sport, especially in Australian schools. And because I just didn't have that available as an option to me, I really wanted to be good at something and to be rewarded and celebrated for something. And I had a natural academic aptitude and I really leaned into that. And I think I was probably that painful teacher's pet that wanted that recognition and acknowledgement from the teacher for being good at something. So acknowledging that I did have ability in the more of the academic, I probably leaned into that significantly and was probably a really annoying little goody two shoes.
And were you always drawn to numbers?
No. I mean, I've always been really good at the maths and sciences, but interestingly, in my earlier years, I was more drawn to the humanities and the creative. So when I was about 5 years old, Mum started me doing piano lessons. And then I eventually, throughout my childhood, then picked up the guitar, the flute and the bassoon. And I really loved creative writing. In particular, in grade three, in Mrs. Elliott's class, she was really big on the humanities and promoted, you know, a lot of music and a lot of creative writing. And I remember being an eight-year-old kid and coming home from school and just filling notebooks with my short stories.
Tell me about your dad, Bob. How passionate was he about cars?
I think it's not a past tense thing. It's been a lifelong obsession for Dad, safe to say. I mean, just yesterday I was over at Mum and Dad's visiting them and I said to Mum, "Where's Dad?" And she rolled her eyes and said, "Where do you think? He's in the garage tinkering on his MGB." So I think that's going to carry through his entire life. But it was very obvious to me when I was little. To go back and talk a little bit more about the asthma treatment, Mum would look after me during the day, but she is somebody that really needs her solid 8 hours of sleep. And fair, like they had to split the responsibility of looking after their sick child. So if I had an attack in the middle of the night, it was Dad that would get out of bed and look after me. And I do think that that particular care forms a pretty unbreakable bond between a parent and a child. Like if you're wrenching your child from not being able to breathe in a pitch black room in the middle of the night and making them feel safe and alive again, that's going to form a closeness that's hard to break. So I think as soon as I cottoned onto the fact that Dad loved cars with an all-consuming passion, I decided that if I loved cars too, it would be an inevitable way for us to spend time with each other.
How would the two of you keep up with the Grand Prix races?
So when I was very young, if you typically look at the Formula One calendar, there's one race in Australia and then maybe a couple in Asia, but all of the rest of them are in North America or Europe, which is the middle of the night for us when they're running live. And so when I was very young, I wasn't allowed to stay up late on a Sunday night and watch it live. So Dad and I would record it, and then Monday night I would get home from primary school or high school and we would watch it together.
Did he race cars himself or was he just a passionate fan of F1?
Yeah, Dad definitely raced cars himself. Apart from being an avid fan of classic British cars typically, Dad also raced what's classed as a Formula V open wheel racing car. So, I mean, it looks like a very basic version of a Formula One car and it's a lot slower than a Formula One car, but I think it probably gives you the same sense of thrill for an amateur racer. So in the years leading up to me being born, Dad would be racing typically every second or third weekend, traveling around Victoria in particular, but also sometimes interstate with Mum begrudgingly in tow as the pit crew. But I think then when Mum and Dad finally fell pregnant with me, Mum called an end to the motor racing. Mum is a very risk-averse person, and I think the idea of her husband and the father to her child jumping in a car that could potentially be life-threatening was a bit too much for Mum, so she insisted that Dad stop the motor racing soon after I was born.
When did you first get to see a Formula One race in real life, Kate?
The first time I got to see a Formula One car in person was at the 1996 Australian Grand Prix. It was the first year that the race had moved from its home in Adelaide to Melbourne, which is the town that I was born and brought up in. And Dad said that my brother and I could have the day off school and come along to watch Friday free practice. And until this point in time, I'd only ever watched them on television. Witnessing it in person on this March day in 1996 was the moment that everything changed for me. To see in person something move at the speed that it moved at on a narrow, windy circuit where, you know, the speed limit at the time was probably 50 or 60 kilometres an hour for a normal road car. And these machines were travelling at up to 330 kilometres an hour. It wasn't actually the speed that was the thing that really got me. It was the noise that the cars made. Back in 1996, they had a V10 engine and it was so loud that the sound of that car would rip through your body.
And are you saying that's like a good thing, Kate? Because even you describing that makes me stressed out that there's a sound that can rip through your body from a V10 engine.
I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, the very fine line between pressure and stress and performance, or like stress and anxiety and exhilaration. And when you look at some of the extreme sports that human beings choose to do for the thrill, I guess for me, Formula One was my extreme sport, and having to wear ear protection to even be at the circuit next to the cars and having the sound of it rip through your body was like what I imagine a drug high feels like. It almost feels like it shouldn't be good for you, but you're surviving it. And yeah,
Want to drive them yourself?
I did want to drive them myself. I saved up my pennies to buy myself a competitive professional go-kart when I was at high school as well. And I signed up to the Go-Kart Club of Victoria, which is this fabulous track at the base of the Westgate Bridge in Melbourne. And I would drag Dad every moment that I possibly could to the circuit so I could practice laps. And I guess similar to qualifying in Formula One, I almost prefer watching qualifying than I do the race, because it is the individual competing against themselves to try and get the fastest lap time they can possibly get. And that, as competition, really resonates with me. I'm a very competitive person, but I'm mainly competitive with myself. And so for me, going to the go-kart track after school every night and just trying to, you know, get tenths of a second, you know, perfect the braking point, the acceleration point, the apex of the corner, that was really exhilarating and stimulating for me. But I think Dad got sick of going to the circuit and, you know, he's a racer. It's in his blood. And he wanted to just get me out and into a go-kart race. And the very first weekend that he convinced me to sign up, I was so nervous. And I was waiting by my go-kart. My race was going to be the following one. And in the race before me, a guy flipped his go-kart and he got thrown out of it. And he was thrown into this flywire fencing. And I looked at Dad. I'm like, I am not racing. And he said to me, get in the bloody go-kart and race. And it was the first and last race I ever did. So yeah, maybe Formula One driver wasn't for me.
So instead you decided you wanted to design these extraordinary Formula One cars. So why did you study aerospace engineering at university?
I took myself along to the RMIT Careers Day, and going along, I was utterly convinced. I'd done pre-research and I'd found a course called automotive engineering, and it was similar to mechanical engineering, but it focused specifically on the automotive industry. And to my mind, that felt like the perfect and natural degree to study to get into Formula One. So when I showed up at the open day, I went up to the engineering booth and there was a few lecturers stood there waiting to speak to, you know, prospective students. I spotted the friendliest looking one and went up and chatted to a guy called Dr. Bertolini. And I said to him, I want to work in Formula One as a designer and I'm thinking about studying automotive engineering. And he said, have you ever considered aerospace engineering? Because a Formula One car performs more like an aircraft than it does a car. And I think it would give you the edge to get into that industry. And so I'm like someone that gathers and collects bits of information and builds this dossier. And so I went from wanting to be a Formula One driver, failing at that, knowing I was good at maths and science, picking out based on my basic level of research, automotive engineering, but then speaking to someone and them saying aerospace would be better. So I'm like chipping away at this dream and honing it and getting closer to it. So that would have been in 1997. I went along to the Careers Day. And yeah, from then on for me, it was clear that it would be aerospace engineering that I studied.
So even having completed that incredibly demanding course, how hard is it to then land a job in the world of F1?
I want to be really clear that while the degree was incredibly challenging, and you know, that the subject matter that we covered would challenge the most academic of people, I loved every single second of that degree. I think, you know, when you're going through high school and you have to study certain subjects to complete your VCE or the state equivalent, you're often learning some things that you think, well, I have to do this, but it's not really pointing me in the direction that I want to go. And then arriving at aerospace engineering, I knew that everything I was learning was going to be valuable to me in the career that I wanted to achieve. And I threw myself into that degree with like a passion and an energy. It was very long. It was 40 contact hours a week. And I'd come home from uni every day and study till 2 or 3 in the morning. But I was so fulfilled by what I was learning. And I felt like I was propelling myself towards this dream career. But you're right. Like, there are probably hundreds of thousands of qualified aerospace engineers in the world. But in Formula One, there's maybe, even at the bigger teams, there's maybe 15 aerodynamicists, which is the job that I wanted. And then if you've got 10 teams, there's 150 of these jobs in the world. And I can guarantee you that more than 150 people in the world want those jobs. So you have to try and make yourself stand out from everybody else. So apart from studying aerospace engineering, I'd also talked myself into a voluntary role with a Formula 3 team based in Melbourne. And I started going out to their factories and insisting that the mechanics put up with me. I just wanted to learn by osmosis being around them. And then I got the opportunity to go to some of the race weekends, and that was a really eye-opening experience for me. It was thrilling to be trackside with a team, seeing this car that I'd watched the mechanics work on back at the factory finally performing in the way it was meant to. One of my lecturers from aerospace had told me about a master's that was offered at a university in the UK called a Master's of Motorsport Engineering and Management. And they only had about 15 spots every year. And the course was partially funded by some Formula One teams. So if you scored one of those spots, that was a golden ticket into Formula One. So I applied for that master's straight out of university and I was accepted for it. So I think as soon as I knew that I was going to Cranfield, I knew that eventually I would be working in a Formula One team.
Well, you were eventually offered a job at the venerable F1 team Williams in Oxfordshire. Forget how excited you were, Kate. How excited was your dad?
As teenagers, we can be quite insular and wrapped up in our own lives. I think, but you know, we could extend that to being selfish. But I'd been so focused on this singular dream for so long, and I'd been working towards it. Like, they're almost two separate things. This idea that I wanted to work in Formula One took on its own life, but loving watching Formula One with Dad was actually a different thing. And it's funny that until I actually got the job with Williams and left Australia to go and work with them, I hadn't been able to separate the two. I thought that they were intrinsically connected. But it was only the day that I was leaving Australia to fly to the UK that I had this moment of real anxiety and sadness where I thought, me achieving this dream means that I can't watch Formula One with my dad anymore.
Did you ever get to meet Sir Frank Williams, the famous founder?
I didn't only just get to meet him. I actually got to work with him on several occasions, which is probably the highlight of my Formula One career. The most notable of those is the first time I met him. It was in my first week at Williams, and it became obvious very quickly that in Formula One, you don't work contracted hours. You always work significantly longer than that, even if you're staying on top of your workload. So I was in the office at about 9 o'clock on the Thursday night, and it just started to thin out. People were just starting to go home, which is wild. You know, that's well past a healthy dinner time. Many of these guys that I was working with had wives and kids at home. Anyway, I was sitting in the office and Sir Frank entered the office and rolled down the central corridor, which my desk faced out onto.
He was in a wheelchair.
Yes. Yeah. And I saw him go past my desk and then pump the brakes on the wheelchair and put it in reverse. And then he looked over my cubicle and exclaimed, "Oh my God, it's a girl." And it was startling. Like, I think already I was in a bit of shock that I was in the same air as Sir Frank. But then for him to care enough to acknowledge me, but in the way he acknowledged me, it was such a surreal moment that I was meeting this legend of the sport, you know, someone who's won so many of the Constructors' Championships and his team's won many of the Drivers' Championships. They're really ingrained in history, the Williams F1 team, and he's been at the helm the entire time this team's existed. It's his name above the door. That night we got chatting and he asked where I was from and expressed how much he loved when he'd been able to visit Australia and Melbourne. And from then on he remembered my name, which felt extraordinary that, you know, he ran a team of 500 people, but every time he came into the office, he always made a point to address me by name and ask how mum and dad were. And then I had a few opportunities also where he joined us in the wind tunnel during testing. And I just have unfettered access to Sir Frank Williams and his brilliant mind.
Well, he was surprised that you were there as a girl. How many other women were working in the aerodynamics department?
I was the only female working in the aerodynamics department, and that was a facility of 120. I was actually the only female working in a technical capacity in the entire organisation at the time. There were a handful of women working in hospitality, human resources and marketing, but from a designer and engineering perspective, there was only me.
And what was that like? I mean, was that something you were bothered by, or it was just the nature of the work? How did it register on you back then?
I honestly wasn't bothered by it. I think maybe there had been times in my life where, for example, volunteering at the Formula 3 team, I was definitely bullied for being a girl. But Formula 1, when you think about it, is the pinnacle of motorsport and they get to have the pick of the bunch. So you have the best brains in the business working. And everyone who worked at Williams had to work as hard as I had to get that job. And so by the time you achieve that, I wasn't the girl working in the office. I was another aerospace engineer that had worked just as hard as everyone else to get there. I think the only difference was that I loved a chat. And I think if you look at that stereotypical engineering mold, it is typically someone that's more introverted, that enjoys solo quiet work, typically computer-based. I don't mind solo quiet work, but I need it to be balanced really in a really healthy way with human interaction and collaboration and communication.
So you mentioned, Kate, that there were times where Sir Frank joined you in the wind tunnel.
Yes.
What's the wind tunnel and what were you doing in it?
Oh, so the wind tunnels, plural, were one of the most incredible things about being able to work at Williams. Many of the other teams only have one wind tunnel. They're incredibly expensive to run. It models the car static, but then these huge fans generate wind, so you can simulate a car moving through air to understand how the aerodynamic components are working and affecting the performance of the car. So typically, like, this is very much in layman's terms, but the car in the 60% wind tunnel at Williams would sit on four static plates that measured downforce, and then there were other data points to measure drag. So if you were testing a new aerodynamic component, it could tell you whether it was an improvement on the baseline design or not. Then we also had a full-scale rolling road wind tunnel, which, to get really technical, the 60% static tunnel didn't take into account the changes of the tyres actually rotating on the road and how that affects the aerodynamics of the car from everything from the tyres back. So the rolling road, you can simulate the movement of the tyres as well, and it gives a more accurate picture of the aerodynamic performance of the car.
So were you in seventh heaven, Kate? Like, when you describe your passion for this sport, your determination for this to be your career, the competitiveness to get you this sort of sought-after position?
The only time I was probably really in seventh heaven from a work perspective was when we were doing wind tunnel testing at Williams, because that was when I when you sort of got to see the results of the work that you were doing day to day at your computer. But the office was split into, there was a front end, a mid and a rear team that were each comprised of a senior aerodynamicist, an aerodynamicist and a designer. And then there was a computational fluid dynamics team. And we rotated use of the wind tunnel. So we typically got the wind tunnel 1 week of every month. And the other 3 weeks you would spend sitting at a computer modelling parts that would be tested in the wind tunnel. The frustrating part for me was that I had ideas about, you know, I although I was only a junior aerodynamicist, I'd been following Formula One for, like, dedicatedly for more than a decade, but prior to that watching it with my dad with interest. And I had ideas on new aerodynamic concepts, but that's not the hierarchy when you work in Formula One. When you come in as a junior aerodynamicist, all the ideas in your department come from the senior aerodynamicist and you simply work on modelling their ideas. And while from a personal perspective, I really liked my senior aero at Williams, he wasn't a great communicator. And most of the time he would have an idea that he wanted to test. He wouldn't explain to me why we were testing it. He would simply ask me to model it. And then I would spend 3 weeks of the month modelling his ideas. We'd then go into the wind tunnel and test them, which I found exciting, but equal parts frustrating, because if the part tested proved to not be as good as the baseline design, we would just scrap it. And I really wanted to understand, like, maybe it didn't perform the way we hoped it would perform, but surely we could still learn something from it. But in Formula One, the turnover of design is so fast that if a part doesn't work, you don't have the time to analyse why it doesn't work and maybe learn from it. You've got to move on to the next idea that you have in the hope that it will be better. And I just found that incredibly frustrating.
So how did that stress start showing up in your body, Kate?
Everyone acknowledges when you come into an organisation in a junior role, you've got to earn your respect through time and proving yourself to be granted more responsibility and more opportunity. But when I looked around the office, guys that had been there for 2, 3, 4 years were doing roles very similar to me. And I was thinking to myself, if I knew that in 6 months' time my role was going to get more interesting and stimulating, I can stick this out. But I can't do this for the next 4 years. It's just not going to make me happy. So inadvertently, another F1 team, it's a very incestuous world to work in. Like, the hardest thing is getting in. And once you're in, people move around the teams a lot because you've technically already proven that you're good enough to work in Formula One. So you're a safer bet than pulling in someone that's never worked in F1 before. So another team had heard about the female aerodynamicist at Williams, and they called me one day and asked if I'd be interested in being interviewed for a role as an aerodynamicist at their team. And I went along to the interview thinking there's nothing to lose. I'll probably say no, because Williams was my dream team. But after the interview, I confided in one of my colleagues at Williams who had worked at this other team previously. And he said, look, it's a smaller team. They don't have as big a budget as Williams, and they don't have as many people working in the aerodynamics department. So just by way of, you know, the workload has to be split between less people, so you will have more responsibility. And he said it was a great place for him to learn. So he recommended that maybe I take it to extend myself and grow as an engineer in F1. And it was scary leaving Williams behind, because that had been the team that I dreamt of working for since I was a child. But it was either like keep banging my head against the brick wall in the hope that something's going to change or try something new. And the day that I started at the new team, walking into the office that day, on the first day, I knew I'd made a mistake.
So in this period, you're away from home, work is not playing out the way you want. You're stressed, pushing yourself still to really do the best that you can. How did exercise first enter the picture?
I'd started dating one of my ex-colleagues from Williams. We'd decided that it was better that we didn't work together. But then weeks after we started dating, he quit his job at Williams and got a role with the team that I'd moved to, and he was going to be my boss. So we went from thinking it would be healthy dating and not working together to him coming to my new team and being me reporting to him. That worsened the situation at the new team even more for me. And I started to experience frequent panic attacks, which I'd never had in my life. I've always been someone that's performed under pressure and under stress. And it's like that, a diamond, you either shatter or you become this like precious stone. And in the past, pressure and stress had created a precious stone. But in this instance, it started to shatter me. Martin, my partner at the time, I didn't have really any friends. We were both working such long hours and again, male-dominated industry. So my female friendships were few and far between. And I was away from my greatest support network, which had been my parents up until now. So Martin suggested I join the local gym as an effort to meet girls in the town to become friends with them. But by this stage, depression had set in and gone undiagnosed and the anxiety and the panic attacks were happening. And I really started to lean into the gym as the one thing that I could control in my life. It became less about fitness and more about having this the solidness and familiarity and comfort of a routine that I could rely on.
What about your eating habits? How were they changing, Kate?
So alongside the gym, and to give it context here, when I signed up to the gym, it was a YMCA in a country town in the UK. It wasn't run by professional people that manage things like health and fitness plans. It was really like front desk people that might give you a basic fitness plan. So I signed up and there was a 6-week introductory program where you would do all your measurements at the beginning. They would give you basic nutritional cards once a week and then you managed your own program, but every week you'd have a weigh-in and a measurement check. And anyway, in that 6 weeks, I started to see results and, you know, the nutritional cards were so basic, but it was teaching me about things like calories and fat and sugar, all of these things that I'd never thought about before, because up until then I'd always had a healthy appetite. I'd always been healthy. I'd eaten when I was hungry and didn't eat when I wasn't. And you give an engineer information and numbers and they are going to lean into it. And I did. And I think I started to treat the exercise and the eating as a way of controlling two things in my life in a life that felt very much out of control otherwise.
What led you to finally reach out and say you needed help once you become so regimented about your exercise and your eating and you were really on this path of an eating disorder even if you weren't aware of it yet? What led to you finally knowing, acknowledging that you needed some help?
I couldn't. It wasn't a conscious decision to reach out for help. And I think that's crucial for people to understand that once you get to a point with an eating disorder where your weight is below a certain level, you lose the ability of rational thought. Like I was incredibly moody. Like my mood swings were extreme. The relationship became difficult to be in, probably even more so for my partner than me. He was seeing me disappear and he was trying to help, but I didn't want to be helped. It's like you are in such denial about your situation, but all you want to hold on to is these two elements of control. And anyone that threatens those two elements of control becomes the enemy. So it is a vicious spiral. It really got to the point where I couldn't function in my job. I fell asleep in a meeting. My boss pulled me aside. And I mean, it was negligent that no one had really pulled me aside before this and expressed concern about my health. But it got to the point where I couldn't do my job anymore. And really, my life was completely unmanageable. And I think it wasn't me asking for help. It was my dad giving me permission that I could let go and come home.
When you came back to Australia and started receiving care for the anorexia that you were struggling with, you decided to get a job in a bakery. Why a bakery? Okay.
I love that people think that this is so ironic. It's if you talk to anyone that suffered from an eating disorder, You just want to be around food all the time because you're starving your body of its nutrients. So every part of your body is sending signals to your brain begging you to eat. So you're thinking about food all the time.
So wouldn't that be the worst place to be in? Like, was it a constant test that you're putting yourself through?
It was like a 9-hour staring competition with temptation. But it's funny, it literally was, it was like going back to the go-kart track and day after day going, trying to perfect that lap. Going to the bakery every day, if I resisted snacking on the tiniest little morsel of something, I'd get home from work and I'd feel really triumphant, like I'd succeeded and I'd won. But on the flip side, if I broke character and snacked on a tiny little bite of something, panic would set in. I would beat myself up. I would compensate dramatically the following day. I'd get home from work and it was the middle of winter and I was skeletal and I would just walk for hours around the streets.
You ended up working at a cafe called Usia.
Perfect pronunciation. Mary would be very proud.
Well, tell me about the couple who ran that.
Oh, first of all, they are just angels on earth, those two. I had discovered Usia in a similar way to wanting to work at that bakery. Usia became like a haven of safety where I would go and have my morning coffee. And even just by being in the tiny space surrounded by Mary's cooking, I was kind of enjoying food by osmosis and just living vicariously through everyone else around me enjoying it. But I would just sit there and I would observe and witness Mary, who is just this Greek goddess of a woman, like the most beautiful person you can possibly imagine, and just radiating compassion and kindness. And it was all coming out through her cooking. And I eventually built up enough courage to ask her, and God knows why she said yes, but I asked her if she would let me help out with some of the baking in the cafe. And she gave me a very small part-time job. It was like 4 hours a day to come in and help with the baking. And then I had to go home. And I didn't understand that at the time. I was like, why don't you just give me a full-time job? You know, I'll come and work for you. I'm happy to work hard. But Mary seemed to be the only person that understood that giving me a little bit of something that stimulated me and made me happy but didn't wear me down and break me would be better for my recovery than giving me what I thought I wanted. So I think I entered a bit of a holding pattern in that time in my recovery where I wasn't necessarily putting on weight, but I was feeling more comfortable and safe being around food and engaging with it and understanding, I guess, the importance of it. So, yeah, Mary gave me so many gifts, but maybe the biggest one was to learn to love food again.
What led to you booking yourself a ticket to Paris, Kate?
I'd finished a shift at Usia one day and I'd requested that the local library buy this copy of a coffee table book about Paris boulangeries and patisseries.
Local libraries are the greatest. I just need to give a shout out to local libraries. Bless them. You ask for a book and they buy it for you. That's so great.
Isn't it? And like Mum had actually told me that because I was barely earning any money and a lot of the money that I was earning was going towards my medical bills. So I didn't have all of this additional money to go out and buy beautiful cookbooks and books about Paris patisseries. So I'd received an email notification saying that this book had arrived and was ready for my collection. And you know, this is 10:30 in the morning where when you're actively trying to restrict your eating and do exercise, 10:30 in the morning is like you've got the rest of forever ahead before you go to bed because it's just this, literally this game of resistance, which is exhausting. So to have something to distract you, like a new book to pick up at the library, feels like a gift. So I went back up into Camberwell, picked up the library book, brought it back home and was reverently sitting on the floor of Mum and Dad's lounge room. And I randomly flicked the book open to this double page photo of pain au chocolat. And they were all stacked up. Because they were stacked up and it was the end-on view of them, you could see the perfect lamination in the pastry, but it also looked, I mean, if you squinted your eyes and had a bit of an active imagination, it also looked a little bit like the air particles tracing the flow around an aerofoil section.
If you're an aerospace engineer,
if you're an aerospace
and have a good imagination.
Yeah. And I was so captivated by this photo that I put my shoes back on, went back up to Camberwell to the travel agents up there, and I booked myself a ticket to Paris.
once you landed, did you head straight for that boulangerie that had created that amazing array of
Well, I mean, that would be the logical thing to do, right? No, I didn't. Mary and Al from Ousia actually ended up coming to Paris with me. And we spent this magical week walking the streets of Paris, eating everything together. Had Mary and Al not come with me, I think the anorexia would have very much restricted my enjoyment on that trip. But being around Mary and Al and eating food made me feel safe. Anyway, on the final day, I decided that it was the day I was going to go visit Du Pain et des Idées, which is the boulangerie where the photo was taken. And Mary and Al went off to do their own thing. And it felt appropriate to me that I had this little solo moment of reverence for this boulangerie that had made me book the whole trip. And it was transformative.
In what way?
A boulangerie is a very humble thing when you think about it. Like, a bakery produces our daily bread that we'll make a sandwich with or toast or pair with our dinner to mop up a soup or a stew or whatever. It's very humble food. But when I was an engineer, I'd visited Paris several times, but I'd witnessed the city through the eyes of an engineer. The silver lining of the anorexia was it turned me into a foodie, ironically. And this was the first time I was really witnessing Paris through the eyes of someone who adored food, even if it wasn't necessarily gorging on it and eating it. Like, I had a deep appreciation for food now. And I stood outside this boulangerie in the little line of people that were all waiting for their daily, very humble breakfast croissant. And it was like I was witnessing a French boulangerie for the first time. Like, really what it brings to a community. It's the heart and soul of a community. Everyone in that neighborhood will go there every day in France to get their morning croissant, their lunchtime baguette and whatever. It's a very special thing to witness through new eyes.
You actually ended up going back to Paris and spending some time training at that boulangerie. Were there any similarities between the pastry kitchen and the world of Formula One that you were familiar with?
The raw pastry kitchen in the boulangerie was spotless. Like, I'd never seen a bakery that didn't have, you know, dusty bits of flour all over the place. The boulangerie reminded me of the race bay at the Williams F1 team, where that was so clean you could have eaten your dinner off the floor and it was kept pristine. Every tool, every screw, every bolt had its specific place that it belonged. And this boulangerie was the bakery world version of that. I think the more human comparison is similar to working as a junior aerodynamicist in F1. The hierarchy played a really important part in how much you impacted, you know, the design of the car in Formula One. Just as in the boulangerie, I was a stagiaire, which is an unpaid intern, and I worked under the head pastry chef and I had no say. It was a privilege that I even got to be in that space and observe what they were doing. And that was the payment for me working for free. I got to observe how a world-class bakery operates, but I wasn't really allowed to do anything. It was a shock that they even let me make the croissant dough, but that was step one of a three-day process. I've had this thought recently that with Formula One, I had a similar experience with both F1 and the bakery. I wasn't allowed to impact the process or the design in a creative or an innovative way. I was allowed to observe. And like at the bakery, I did very simple jobs. Like, I'd make big vats of custard or frangipans or do like very simple, like repetitive line work, placing apples on tarts. I loved it. But I knew that that wasn't my end game, because in the downtime, I would watch the head pastry chef and I'd observe him doing something thinking, why don't you do it this other way? Because this other way, the pastry would be more perfect, or it would be faster or more efficient, or the butter would go further to the edges of the pastry. I couldn't leave Formula One and start my own F1 team, but I could leave a boulangerie and start my own bakery.
So when you did that, when you came back to Melbourne, decided you're going to start trying to make croissants yourself, What did your engineering brain tell you to do differently? What did you work out? What did you reverse engineer?
I had this like harebrained idea that I was going to start my own bakery when I returned to Melbourne, because no bakery in Melbourne was making croissants like what I'd experienced at Du Pain et Desi Day. So I had this harebrained idea. I signed the lease on a small shop, came up with a business name, signed like the food certificates, did my little course, you know, learned how to log fridge temperatures, bought all the bakery equipment, used my life savings. I'm standing in this fully fitted out bakery ready to make croissants. And I made the croissant dough, which had been my job in France, popped it in the fridge for its like long, slow, cold fermentation overnight. And then the next day I pulled it out of the fridge and I remember looking at it and thinking, oh my God, I don't know what to do next. And there was 2 full days worth of processes. I'd done the easiest part, making the dough. I had no idea really how. I just watched Sebastian laminate the butter into the dough. I'd never seen a croissant being proven or baked. None of that. We hadn't worked in the bakery downstairs. I'd spent my life savings and quit my job and moved out of my apartment to start a business where I maybe knew 5-10% of this process. But I'm an engineer. And I think in that moment, I wasn't willing to give up. And I thought, if I can imagine that final perfect croissant, it doesn't matter how long it takes me, I can figure out how to make it by using engineering process, testing, changing one variable each day, tracking the effect of that variable. And so I started it. I started this, like, designing a Formula One car, but croissant version.
How long did it take you until you created a batch that you were happy with that was like Grand Prix ready?
From beginning that first day of making the dough and realizing to pulling a batch of croissants out of the oven that I knew was good enough for me to start going to market. I knew they weren't perfect. That was every day for 3.5 months working on it. Which sounds like a lot, but like think about the level of fulfillment that you know you're chipping away and progressing, getting closer and closer to the goal that you want. Mm. And like, I think that is a theme in my life where I like chipping away on something to improve myself or to improve something that I'm working on. And this was kind of the dream for me. I'd created this business and I knew that every single day I was getting closer to the goal.
When you started selling these croissants directly to the public, how quickly and in what way did the public react?
So initially the model of the business was, you know, my little shop was in a beautiful little bayside suburb in Melbourne that was hard to access. It wasn't in a strip of shops. It wasn't a great location for a retail bakery. So I had this idea that I could make croissants and I could supply them to Melbourne's best espresso bars. Specialty coffee was really taking off in Melbourne at the time. And there were these exceptional little bars serving espresso, but they'd have brownie or cookies on the counter as their food offering. But I don't want a brownie at 7 o'clock in the morning, but I do want a good croissant. So I had a list of wholesale customers, and pretty quickly it got to the point where I would show up to some of these bars and there was a line of people waiting for me to show up with the pastry. And sometimes they'd all sold before I'd even arrived. And it was, do you remember like back in the day with like school lunches and you'd write your order on a paper bag and you'd get your sausage roll or whatever. Yeah. It was like that. There was a stack of paper bags. There was almond croissant, pain au chocolat, traditional croissant, and all the pastries would go straight from my delivery boxes into the bags and never make it to the counter.
Were you registering that as something pretty amazing? Like, could you take
that? Oh, God,
in?
No. I was working too hard. I was working like 90 hours a week. It was wild. And one of the reasons I wasn't registering it was I would literally drop off the box and then I would run because I'd have 8 or 10 deliveries to do. And then I had to get back to the kitchen and start making the following day's croissants. It was relentless. So I guess similar to designing an F1 car, being factory based, but never getting to be at the circuit and witnessing that final product race, again with croissants, I was producing these pastries that I knew were popular, but I never got to see people eating them, enjoying them. I was too busy back in the kitchen making the next lot.
Has that changed by now, Kate? Do you get to see people loving the croissants that you create at Loon?
Well, it changed because I changed it. I had a moment about 18 months into the business where I decided that I wanted to turn my little kitchen into a customer-facing bakery. And at that point in time, I brought my brother on as a business partner and he helped me convert it to a little retail shopfront. And that was where Loon really started to become like a mythical creature. People would start lining up at about 2 o'clock in the morning.
What?
And wait 6 hours.
That was crazy.
Yeah, that with like it was equal parts incredible, but also a little bit unnerving to know that there were people stood out in the middle of the night in the dark just for hours waiting for us to open. And I can tell you now, every single morning, Cam and I would think this will be the day where no one lines up. And every morning we would open the little barn door and there would be 120 people snaked around the block. And we're like, oh, here we go again. It was wild.
As someone who's always been so driven by ambition and a goal, given the huge success of Loon, does that mean you've had to find a different target? Mm. You had to have a new ambition?
I mean, I've obviously had big challenges in my life, in particular health challenges with the asthma and the anorexia. But I actually think the biggest personal challenge for me has been accepting that nothing stays the same and you have to evolve with it if you want to continue to be a part of it. And I don't think that I could have done that in my 20s, but with Loon, like Loon came from such a pure, important part in me, which was really the recovery of my eating disorder. It took the place of the eating disorder in my brain and allowed me to move on from that. But in the beginning, every single job was mine because I was a one-woman business. And now I have nearly 300 staff. And progressively over the years, every job that was mine has been handed to someone else. And I've had to let go of control, which is, control makes me so happy. It gives me a feeling of reassurance and safety. And to let go of control really challenges me as a person.
And do you and your dad still watch Formula One together?
It's funny. I went through a period of time where I couldn't watch Formula One, in particular when I was sick. It was just too painful. But I did find my way back to it. And I now think I love it more than ever because I've had the experience of working in the industry, which so few people have. And I now understand the incredibly hard work that goes on behind the scenes in quiet offices with an extreme amount of pressure on those engineers and designers and mechanics and model makers and everyone to make the spectacle that we get to enjoy on the TV or at the circuit come to life. And maybe what I loved about Formula One all along was getting to watch it with my dad.
Now you get to sit together and eat a really good croissant at the same time. So that's a win-win. Kate Reid, it's been a real pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Thanks, Sarah.
My guest on Conversations today was Kate Reid, the founder and director of Loon Croissanterie. And if Kate's story has raised any issues for you, then I really recommend the Butterfly Foundation as a great place for resources around eating disorders. This conversation was recorded on the lands of the Turrbal and Yagara peoples. It was produced by Alice Moldovan, and our executive producer here at Conversations is Nicola Harrison. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.